So you just heard James Crumbly, the father of Michigan school shooter Ethan Crumbly, throw himself at the mercy of the court as the judge decides what his sentencing will be. Just as a reminder, James Crumbly, just like his wife Jennifer, were each separately convicted on 4 counts of involuntary manslaughter. And one of the reasons, at least for James Crumbly, is because prosecutors said that the parents showed a, quote, chilling lack of remorse. And for him, for James Crumbly, the prosecuting attorney, Karen McDonald, said that Crumbly called threatening, saying, "There will be retribution, believe me." Jane Casares, I know that you're still here with us. That is a very different approach that you just heard him take now, which to me sounded a lot more contrite than Jennifer Crumbly in her speech just shortly before he spoke. Tearful, saying that, "I know you don't believe me," to the family members of the 4 teenagers whom his son killed. "I'm sorry for your loss. I would have done a lot of things differently. And I too grieve for your children." Jean?
You know, Dana, a very interesting point at the end when he said that to the parents, he said, "I want to echo what Tate Meir's father said. We want to know the truth. You do not know the whole truth. You don't know it." And that goes along with, I think, a legal issue that may come about on appeal, because both parents wanted their son, Ethan Crumbly, to come into the courtroom during their trials and to testify. Because Ethan had texted to his friend in the middle of the night, "I have asked my dad to help me. I need mental help. He told me to suck it up and take a pill." Well, once he was arrested, Ethan Crumbly, he had a jail psychiatrist talk with him and assessing him, but asking him about different things. And one of those things was the text that he wrote about his mental health. He told, according to testimony in the Miller hearing, which was Ethan Crumbly's precursor to his sentencing hearing, he told the jail psychiatrist that he lied. He said, "You know, I never asked my dad for help. That's a lie. I just said that to my friend." And the parents wanted that testimony to come into the trial to show that they did not know mentally what was happening to him. But the appellate attorneys for Ethan Crumbly said no. First of all, he is not going to waive his Fifth Amendment right to come in and testify to that. Secondly, these are medical records. We're not waiving those medical records. So there was no way for the parents to counter that text that he wrote to his friend unless they took the stand to say, "We didn't know that." James Crumbly opted to not take the stand. That's his constitutional right. So that came in without anything to counter it.
Very interesting. And yeah, there's no question that what you said is true. We will probably see and hear a lot of that on appeal. And just to reiterate, what the judge is deciding is how much, if any, prison time each of these individuals, the parents of Ethan Crumbly, should get. And they each face up to 15 years in prison. And we're going to take a quick break. But before we do, I want to remind people, the individuals, the teenagers that we're talking about who were murdered in the prime of their life, before they were even getting started, really, with their lives. Madison Baldwin, age 17, Tate Meir, age 16, Hannah St. Juliana, age 14, Justin Schilling, age 17. We'll be right back.
The Assignment with me, Audie Cornish. Celebrities of all kinds are speaking publicly about their therapeutic trips, so to speak. It turns out there is a burgeoning industry ready to serve the new influx of people who find themselves turning away from traditional mental health therapy. The gap between what we know and what we don't about psychedelic therapy. Listen to The Assignment with me, Audie Cornish, on your favorite podcast app.
More breaking news at this hour. Donald Trump's legal team is about to leave a New York City courthouse after a hastily called hearing about the latest gag order placed on the former president in his hush money case. CNN's Caitlin Polance is following these developments. Caitlin, What happened inside that courtroom?
Well, our team in New York is following this quite closely, and things are moving quite fast here, Dana. There was this appeal that Donald Trump, his team took to the court today over the gag order that he is under, where he can't speak about witnesses, court staff, the DA's office, even the judge's family. His attorneys in those arguments said he might be rude, but this isn't incitement. This is something that is causing Donald Trump irreparable harm. And there apparently was a request to delay the case on the table as well from his team. That's not going to happen, according to the reporting we're getting out of our team in New York. Just after that appeal was heard, we get the decision just a few minutes ago. There isn't going to be a delay of the trial because of this gag order issue. The DA's office was clearly successful in arguing to the appellate judge that the witnesses are hesitant, that this gag order is within the law. So there's going to be a flurry of things that happen as we await the beginning of this trial on Monday. Mm-hmm. And that flurry right now is Donald Trump's team making these requests to delay, to move the case out of New York, to challenge the gag order. And the appeals court in New York Supreme Court, they're looking at these quite quickly and giving same day decisions.
Yeah, that was just gonna say, I mean, not only same day, like 5 minutes after the hearing was over. I want to stand by for 1 second, Caitlin. I want to bring in former U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of New York, Ellie Honig. Ellie, what's your read on what just happened in that courtroom in New York?
Well, Dana, zero surprise on this one. First of all, even if there was going to be some modification, some change to the gag order made by the appeals court, that would have nothing to do with this trial starting as scheduled on Monday, April 15th. And second of all, this gag order is very narrow. It's actually quite remarkable to hear Donald Trump say it infringes on his rights or it's impeding his ability to defend himself, because all that the gag order does is it prohibits Donald Trump from commenting publicly about jurors, about witnesses, and then about court and prosecutor staff and family members. He is free, and he has taken full advantage of his freedom to attack the case, the judge himself, and the DA himself. So it's no surprise Donald Trump lost this one. And as Caitlin said, he's been losing these arguments really quickly. I think collectively the judges in the New York state system are sending a message that this thing is going on Monday and he's not getting out of it.
Yeah, it's hard to understand the Trump attorney argument that having him not talk about the judge's family or potential jurors is doing the former president irreparable damage. This is going to happen, it seems, in 6 days. So what's going to happen soon is, or first, is jury selection. I want to read a part of the questionnaire for potential jurors. Have you ever considered yourself a supporter of or belong to any of the following? The QAnon movement, Proud Boys, Oath Keepers, Three Percenters, Bungalow Boys, Antifa. Ellie, can you, I mean, the question is pretty straightforward. The idea is they're trying to weed out people who are pro-Trump. We should also give some context. This is Manhattan, and this is a place where Joe Biden won by 86.7%, Donald Trump by 12.3%. I guess there certainly could be part of that 12.3% in the potential jury pool.
Yeah, Dana, this questionnaire is really interesting because it's doing a dance of sorts. What it's trying to do is figure out, where do you stand on Donald Trump? Do you have views for or against him that are so strong that you can't possibly rule fairly on that case? Now, they do ask that question straight up. Is there anything about your views of this case or Donald Trump
that would
keep you from answering fairly?
We can put that up, forgive me. Question number 34 as you continue to talk. Didn't mean to interrupt you, Ellie.
No, that's fine. And then there are other questions that they don't ask that you would think would be logical to ask, like, did you vote for Donald Trump in 2020? Are you a registered Democrat or Republican? But in lieu of those direct questions, they sort of ask these glancing questions, like the one you just showed. Are you aligned with QAnon? Are you aligned with Antifa? There's other sort of less out there ways that they try to get at that. They say, where do you primarily get your news? From what source? Mm-hmm. They say, have you ever been to a Trump rally or an anti-Trump rally? Have you ever worked for or against a Trump political organization? But I'll tell you, Dana, what the lawyers are looking for. Look, the textbooks say we're looking for fair jurors who can call it right down the middle. This is a competitive exercise. The lawyers are looking for jurors who are inclined for their side. If you're the DA, frankly, you want people who dislike Donald Trump. And if you're Trump's team, mm-hmm. you want people who support him. I know it's about the facts and the law, too, but let's be real. This is jury selection. This is a competitive exercise.
Which is always, Caitlin, a competitive exercise, no matter what kind of courtroom you're in. Even more so when the courtroom is effectively a very important campaign stop or an important campaign event.
Yeah, and one thing we're seeing right now, Dana, is there's going to be a continued conversation, arguments, motions, very quick decisions that happens outside of the presence of the jury. So they get this jury seated. We're going to go through jury selection. We'll watch that. But what's presented to the jury is not even the only thing that's going to happen in court. So there's going to be what Trump says to the cameras, the campaign type events of him walking in and out. We're not going to be seeing the proceedings live. We're going to be hearing about them through our reporters who are in the room watching. And then there's the legal arguments and then what the jury itself sees.
So this is going to be a taste of what's to come when this hearing starts. And that is, let's go to our reporter who was in the courtroom for that gag order appeal that happened very quickly. Kara Scannell, I believe you were with us. There you are, Kara. What happened inside?
Yeah, Dana, so the judge denied this motion to stay the trial so they could make arguments on the gag order. And, you know, Trump's lawyers came in saying that the gag order is restricting Trump from defending himself in this case. And they said they're seeking limited relief. They want him to be able to address two witnesses who have been outspoken about this case, Stormy Daniels and Michael Cohen. They also said that Trump should be able to call out what he views as political interference, one of the prosecutors on this case, and focusing on his ability to speak about a motion that has been publicly filed, that is when they've asked the judge to recuse himself. You'll remember the judge had altered his gag order that he put in place to cover his daughter because Trump was focusing on work that she does for Democratic groups. Now, the prosecutors argued that this was much more than what they were asking for. They want to stop the trial so they can make these arguments. They said that this is far too late. They could have brought this case up on appeal once the judge had issued the gag order, even before he amended it, but they waited till now, just 1 week before the trial. You know, how this is going to play out is that this judge denied for now, but a full panel will get briefs on whether to stop this trial based on this argument. Now, those briefs are due on April 15th. That is the day this trial starts. There will not be oral arguments, and the judges will issue a written decision sometime after the 15th, once jury selection is underway. You know, that is the first part of this, and then they are going to still try to continue to challenge the gag order even after this initial decision on whether the trial starts on time is made. Dana?
Kara, thanks for running out and giving us that report. A lot of breaking news this morning so far. Stick around, we'll be right back. We're going to go back to the crumbly sentencing trial. We're listening to the judge, Cheryl Matthews.
The costs are $272. There's a crime victim's rights fee of $130. You and your agents may not have any contact with the families of Madison Baldwin, Tate Meir, Hannah St. Juliana, and Justin Schilling. I will issue another ruling with regard to contact with your son, the shooter. Excuse me. As to defendant James Crumbly, it is the sentence of this court that you serve 10 to 15 years with the Michigan Department of Corrections, that you receive credit for 858 days, that you pay state costs in the matter of $272, that there is a crime victim's rights fee of $130, that you or your agents have no contact with the families of Madison Baldwin, Tate Meir, Hannah St. Juliana, and Justin Schilling. Ms. Wheeler, have I left anything out with regard to sentencing? No restitution has been requested by any of the families at this time, correct?
That's correct.
Thank you. I would like to advise both defendants that you are entitled to appellate review of your conviction and sentence, including that the sentence exceeds the guideline range. This is done by filing a claim of appeal by right, and when you are not entitled to file a claim of appeal by right, an application for leave to appeal. If you cannot afford to hire an attorney to represent you on appeal, and you request an attorney may be appointed for you. You may request an attorney by completing the request for appointment of attorney section of the form that will be provided for you and by returning the form to this court or to the Michigan Assigned Counsel System at the address on the form. If you wish to preserve your automatic right to appeal, the form must be received within 42 days after sentencing. If you do not submit the form within 42 days from today, you may still file an application for leave to appeal if the form is received within 6 months after sentencing. Do each of the defendants acknowledge receipt of their appellate rights?
Names acknowledges receipt, Your Honor, who's completing the form as we speak.
Your Honor, my point is as well. Would the court like the forms here? Would you prefer us to?
It doesn't matter either way. Okay. Either way.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'm going to ask that everyone remain seated while the defendants are taken out of the courtroom. I think they're going to finish their appellate rights.
They are going to. Mr. Crumbly is going to finish his appellate.
All right. Order. We'll wait for that.
Thank you, Your Honor.
I would just ask that no one stand up. It makes the deputies nervous. So.
Major development in that courtroom, the judge sentencing Jennifer Crumbly and James Crumbly to 10 to 15 years in prison, which is precisely what prosecutors wanted the judge to do. I want to go straight to Jean Casares, who has been following this trial since the beginning. Jean.
Well, the judge, in pronouncing this decision, said, first of all, this is not a case about guns. It's not about guns in the private home. It's about repeated actions over and over and over again by the parents that amounted to gross negligence, that the father, James Crumbly, allowed access to that gun to his son, that the mother, Jennifer Crumbly, glorified it. And at the school meeting that day, the morning 2 hours before the mass shooting, when they were shown these math drawings of bullets and blood everywhere, my life is useless. She said, is this over? And just wanted to get back to work. She said it was very stark, the non-caring aspect of this. And also when Jennifer testified that she would not have done anything differently, she said it may have been misunderstood, but it really, really had a stark, stark reaction amongst the victims. She said the guidelines were not enough. So right there, because the guidelines for these crimes were 4 to 7 years, so you knew something else was coming. The judge said she'd prayed about this. She was up nights worrying about this, thinking about the fact that there is rehabilitation that needs to be done for these victims, but also deterrence so that no one else in this country would do something like this. They have to see that. And then she pronounced the sentence, 10 to 15 years. 15 years is the maximum for this offense.
I want to go to Renato Mariotti as well on this. Renato, I know you, forgive me, I don't think Renato is ready yet. Jean, I just want to put this in context. You have covered, unfortunately, your fair share of trials, particularly when it comes to shootings and even and especially school shootings. The fact that the parents are being held culpable in this case by involuntary or for involuntary manslaughter. Again, they were already convicted of that, but that they are going to be sentenced to 10 to 15 years in prison for that culpability. How significant is this moment?
Absolutely so significant. Prosecutors around the country are watching this case. They are looking at this case. When I interviewed Karen McDonald shortly after the conviction, I said, do you believe that this is precedent setting for other prosecutors in this country to follow suit of what you did? Her response was, they need to ask the question, where did the gun come from? Regarding the minor child, where did it come from? that can launch the investigation right now. And I think that in regard to gun violence, prosecutors are looking at this because someone needs to be responsible. And if you have a minor child and you have a gun in your home knowing there's a minor child and it is not locked, it is sitting around, it is loaded, and something happens, there have been cases where there is child neglect charges for a parent, but not homicide. Mm-hmm. This is what makes this case stand out from any other case that has been brought before in this country.
Okay, I think Renato is with us now. Renato, just pick up where Jean left off about the historic precedent that was just set in Michigan. And also, I mean, Jean was talking rightly about the use of the gun and what the prosecutor, Karen McDonald, has told her about the need for parents to be more mindful of having loaded guns when they have teenagers around. But the other aspect that Jean was talking about, that the judge was talking about, isn't just the weapon, but the apparent disregard with which the shooter's parents treated the warnings that came from the school about the behavior and the mental status of their son. I mean, the fact that that is part of a reason to convict and to sentence to so many years in prison is also pretty remarkable.
It is remarkable. It is unique. I do think that this is a moment. Parents typically, when they're making a choice for their child, they're not thinking about potential prison time as a consequence. And this is significant. This is not 5 days in prison. I mean, we're talking years in prison. I mean, it's a significant sentence, no question about it. And I have to say, you have to think about this in the context of the broader debate that we've had in as a society about firearms. There has not been as much regulation of firearms. There's been a lot of debate about that. And now you're seeing the criminal laws being used in a more aggressive fashion by prosecutors in response to that. In other words, if truly guns are going to be more prevalent, now the onus is going to be on parents to safely store them. If ultimately at the end of the day we're saying that school shootings are a matter of personal responsibility, well, if it's a minor, parents have to see these warning signs, whether it's a dark drawing like there was here, or as the judge mentioned, warning signs coming from the school itself. It's going to, I think, spark a lot more debate in the months and years to come. Mm-hmm.
As it should. Really significant day for this kind of crime, as you said, when it is a minor, but also when it comes to, first and foremost, the feelings of and the grief of the people we heard from earlier today in that courtroom, the parents of Madison Baldwin, Tate Meir, Hannah St. Juliana, and Justin Schilling, the four teenagers who were murdered in cold blood by a 15-year-old in Michigan in 2021. We should continue to remember them. Thank you so much, Renato. Jean, also, thank you for bringing us your reporting and expertise. We're going to sneak in another quick break. Don't go away.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
We've had a lot of breaking news this morning outside of Washington. There's a big story developing here, too. Congress is back from recess, and so are the tensions inside the House Republican Conference. In fact, they're escalating. Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene is doubling down on her calls to oust Speaker Mike Johnson. Today, she's putting all her grievances with his leadership in a scathing five-page letter accusing Johnson of, quote, selling out Republicans by being, quote, in total lockstep with Democrats' agenda. She's blaming him for jeopardizing their razor-thin majority by not serving his own GOP conference that elected him. CNN's Manu Raju is now with us from Capitol Hill. Manu.
Yeah, look, Mike Johnson is coming back into the lion's den of sorts. He has a very complicated legislative agenda ahead. Lots of pressure coming from both sides within his own conference. And that threat from Marjorie Taylor Greene to call for a vote seeking his ouster. Remember, any one member of the House can do just that. We saw that happen in historic and unprecedented fashion last year when Matt Gaetz pushed out Kevin McCarthy as Speaker. Eight Republicans at the time joined with Democrats to vote out McCarthy. Will that happen again? And a large part has to do with Mike Johnson's deal making to keep the government open, but now how he will handle the issue of Ukraine aid, so central to his political future. There's a major push among supporters to get that done immediately. Johnson has not said how he would proceed on that as he's talking to Republicans about a different approach than the Senate. Now, Marjorie Taylor Greene made her grievances known, not just in a letter to her colleagues this morning, but also last night in a town hall back in Georgia.
He's also worked with Hakeem Jeffries and the White House, not with his members. That is not what a Republican Speaker of the House does.
Maybe a Democrat Speaker, actually.
I will not tolerate a Speaker of the House that I voted for to sell us out. I will not tolerate it.
Now, the question is, how many Republicans will join her in this effort? And will Democrats actually step in and try to save Mike Johnson? There would be expected to be a vote to essentially kill this resolution to oust him from the speakership if and when that comes to the floor. Will Democrats side with Johnson, which was not the case with Kevin McCarthy? And a lot of that has to do with how they see how he proceeds on the issue of Ukraine. But again, Mike Johnson has not detailed how he plans to proceed, given the sharp divisions within his own conference on proceeding with Ukraine aid. So he's heading into this difficult period. How he acts and how he responds to all this, still uncertain. But he has not spoken, as we understand, to Marjorie Taylor Greene yet, despite her threats for now couple of weeks.
Well, that was going to be my question. Ukraine is going to play a big role in how this potential vote to vacate the speakership goes down. He was talking over the break about proceeding somehow. What are you hearing about that?
Yeah, this is expected to be different than the Senate's past version that passed almost 2 months ago. That Senate plan, $95 billion for Israel, Ukraine, and Taiwan aid, did not have anything to do with the border security issues. Of course, Republicans had rebelled against a bipartisan border security deal in the Senate, but the Senate moved forward with this aid package absent that. Now Johnson is trying to add some border security provisions, as well as narrow that Ukraine aid, potentially make that Ukraine aid a loan. And Dana, that's the question. Will Democrats be okay with that? Will they save Johnson if he moves forward with this different package? All huge questions for the speaker.
So many questions, a lot of drama, and we really don't know how any of that is going to end. Thank you so much for that reporting, Manu. Appreciate it. Thank you for joining this very busy day here on Inside Politics. CNN News Central starts after the break.
When you work next level. When you play next level. And when it's time to sleep, Sleep Number smart beds are designed to embrace your uniqueness, providing you with high-quality sleep every night. Sleep next level. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, the Queen Sleep Number C4 smart bed is only $1,599. Save $300 for a limited time, only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com. Prices higher in Alaska and Hawaii.
I'm Dr. Sanjay Gupta, host of the Chasing Life podcast. In honor of our 10th season, we want to hear from you. Leave us a message at 470-396-0832 and tell us how you chase life. It could be used on an upcoming episode.